Welcome and thank you for standing by. I would like to remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. If anyone needs assistance during the call, please press star then zero. You may begin. Thank you, everyone, and I'd like to welcome you to the Charm Telecon for September. Today, we have one of the science planners and operations engineers from the magnetometer team. Nick is going to be joining us. I won't even attempt to pronounce his last name because I know I'll butcher it. So he's got some other topics sort of sprinkled throughout his PowerPoint, but he definitely has a whole bunch about what the magnetometer has been seeing in the last year. And with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to you, Nick.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be invited along to give this presentation. I'm going to be talking to you today about mainly magnetic observations made of the planet Saturn by the magnetometer on board the Cassini spacecraft in the first year of its mission. And my name is Nick Achilios. I'm a science planner and operations engineer based at Imperial College, which is, in a sense, mission control for the magnetometer instrument. We can monitor the health and safety of the instrument from Imperial, and we can also command it remotely through secure links that we have with JPL. So it's a very nice way of participating in the mission for us. I've got the names of the people at the Imperial College team on the cover page here. I guess most importantly, our principal investigator is Professor Michelle Doherty, and our operations team leader is Steve Kellogg. Peter and Tim are our operations and data processing guys. Cesar and Chris are involved in the science. And we have many more co-investigators at various places around the globe that you can see there. Today I'll start off by talking about, in very general terms, about the Cassini mission and the journey to Saturn. I'll also show some images from the approach to Saturn, because people always want to see, you know, the pretty pictures of Saturn, and so they should. But I also want to, I'd like you to take away with you, if you could, from today's talk, the fact that not only do we have the visible planet of Saturn, but Saturn is surrounded by an invisible environment that's measured by the field and particles instruments on Cassini, and that environment is just as important in terms of the science that we can learn. I'll describe magnetic field measurements from the first orbit of Cassini and also some of the early orbits. Then I'll look at images, very briefly, at images from the Huygens probe mission to Titan, and although I haven't listed this aspect of the talk here, I'll also talk a little bit about the observations made by the magnetometer at the icy satellite known as Enceladus. Okay, so if we proceed to the next slide, this is just to give us a bit of context. On the top two panels here sort of show us the extremes, if you like, in our knowledge of Saturn. On the left here we have one of Galileo's original sketches of the planet when he was looking at it through his telescope. And his interpretation was almost that Saturn has these lobes or ears adjacent to the body of the planet. But we now know that, of course, this is a low-resolution image of the fantastic ring system that the planet has. And on the right image there, you can clearly see that ring system. This is an image from the imaging science subsystem on Cassini during the first approach to Saturn. And, of course, there are many spectacular images like this easily available to the public. On the bottom here, we have portraits of the two guys after whom the mission is named. We have Giovanni Cassini on the left here. He was born in Genoa in Italy, but he spent his final years at the observatory in Paris, and he studied, among many other things, the moons of Saturn and also the famous gap in the rings. The Cassini division is named after him. On the right, Christian Huygens was born in the Netherlands. Again, he was a true Renaissance man and studied many different areas, but his contributions to planetary science included studies of Saturn's rings, and he is credited with having discovered Saturn's moon Titan. Okay, so the next slide shows us a schematic view of the trajectory of the spacecraft from its launch at the Earth in late 1997. Up to the arrival at Saturn in July last year. You can see that on the way, the spacecraft is planned to fly past a few of the planets of the inner solar system, Venus firstly, then the Earth. And then by the time these flybys have been done, the satellite picks up, the spacecraft picks up a lot of momentum and energy of motion from the gravity assist of these planetary flybys. There was a Jupiter flyby in late 2000, early 2001, and by that stage, the spacecraft could then be well on its way to Saturn, and it arrived there 1st of July 2004. Okay, so the next slide shows us a view of the spacecraft, and to give you an idea of scale here, the high-gain antenna that you see on the top is about 4 meters in diameter. And this is the antenna through which the spacecraft does most of its communications with the Earth. You can see the rim of the Huygens probe, which is tucked behind the main body of the spacecraft in this picture, in the sort of middle right there. And our instrument, the magnetometer, is situated on this long 11-meter boom that you can see extending out from the left-hand side of the spacecraft in this picture. And, of course, the reason we have the magnetic sensors on this boom is that so we can hold them as far as possible from the main body of the spacecraft, because, of course, the main body of the spacecraft, there's lots of electric currents flowing around which generate magnetic fields, and so we want to try and avoid the contamination by those fields as much as possible. Okay, so the next slide, again, gives you an idea of scale. This is the spacecraft being assembled, surrounded by human-sized technicians. So I guess it's the size of something like a small school bus. The next slide, page 6, shows you probably the most critical maneuver in the whole mission, which was the arrival at Saturn and the insertion into the first Saturn orbit of the spacecraft. This is known as SOI, or Saturn orbit insertion. What we're looking at here is a view down onto the northern hemisphere of Saturn. And of course, you can see the plane of the rings and the rings in the system which orbits Saturn itself. The Sun is way off vertically upwards in this picture. You can see Saturn's sunlit face, and you can also see the shadow of the planet on the rings. And the parabolic curve that intersects through the middle of the picture is the spacecraft trajectory. This is Cassini's arrival at Saturn. At the top, at 0 hours 47 minutes. Universal time on July the 1st, the spacecraft ascended up through the gap in the rings between the F and the so-called F and G rings. And a short while later, which is marked by the red segment of the trajectory, the spacecraft fired its main engine, more or less against its direction of motion. And the reason for this was to slow down the spacecraft enough so that it could be captured by Saturn's gravity into orbit around the planet. Okay, so that engine burn lasted for something like 1.5 hours, and at the end of it, the spacecraft was in orbit around Saturn, and there were a lot of happy and relieved scientists and engineers. And if you look towards the bottom of the picture, you can then see the descending wing plane crossing, which occurred about 4 hours or so after the initial ascent. And so Cassini now plunges down, back down through the ring plane, and by this time it's in orbit around the planet and has commenced its 4-year tour of Saturn. Okay, so if we go on to slide number 7, this is an image taken by the ISS Imaging Science Subsystem during the first approach to Saturn. You can see the banded structure of the clouds on the main body of the planet, and of course the ring system, with the Cassini division here very obvious. Moving on to slide number 8, this is just a bit of detail, fine detail of the rings. And images like this, I think, are going to keep ring dynamicists very busy for many years to come. But the main point I want to make here is that you can see these gradations in colour in the rings. There's white and also sort of brown or tan-coloured segments of the rings. And this is thought to be because principally the rings are made of water ice, just like you put it in your drink here on Earth. And these sort of organic compounds known as tholins. So you have icy segments of the rings and also more dirty sections. The Cassini division itself is due to a so-called orbital resonance with the satellite MIMAS. I'm sure someone else has probably spoken to you about that in more detail, but essentially the idea here is that it's very difficult for material in the rings to stay there because the orbital period of material in the rings is an integral multiple of the period of the satellite MIMAS. And so MIMAS pulled on this material at the same stage in its orbit and tends to clear that particular position of ring material. If we go on to slide number 9, this is detail of the F-ring. Very interesting ring. It has a very braided or rope-like appearance. And you can see these, if you look very carefully on the inner side of the ring, you can see these dark diagonal slashes. This is, I believe, or I am told, because the satellite Prometheus orbits very close to the F-ring and at times can pull ring material out of the F-ring. And then the differential motion of the particles in the ring. Remember, the particles which orbit Saturn at larger distances will generally have larger orbital periods. So the differential motion of particles in the ring then draws out those radial features due to Prometheus into these diagonal features. Okay, so if we now go on to slide number 10, we can start talking a little bit about the magnetic aspect of Saturn. So we'll start off in very general terms by looking at planetary magnetic fields in general. And the first picture here is something that probably all of us are familiar with. It's just a simple bar magnet, and it's also drawn in around the bar magnet, which has a north and a south magnetic pole, are the so-called magnetic lines of force. Now, this is a very powerful representation in the way we represent these field patterns, because that it shows us not only the direction of the field but also the strength. Now, the direction of the field is given by the tangent to the lines of force that you see drawn there. So if you place a compass at any point along one of those magnetic field lines, its needle will be locally tangent to that curve. You can see that the field lines are crowded close together, very close to the poles, which indicates field strength is relatively high. And then as you go to large distances from the bar magnet, the field lines are far apart, less dense, if you like, and that means that the field strength is smaller, weaker, with the larger distance from the source, as one would expect. The good news is that the magnetic fields of planets, to a good first approximation, look as though there's a giant strong bar magnet somewhere near the center of the planet. The bottom panel here shows us the case for the Earth. The blue disk is the body of the Earth, and you can see the magnetic field lines which have been drawn in the diagram here, and they have this dipole-like pattern corresponding to the bar magnet. Also shown here is the magnetic axis, which is the axis of symmetry of the field itself. In other words, the line joining the north and south magnetic poles of the bar magnet. And also shown is the rotational axis of the Earth, the axis around which the Earth rotates. And you can see that there's an angle between the two. And in general, we expect this to be the case. And the angle between these two axes is known as the dipole tilt. If we go on to slide 11, there's a table here which makes some comparisons between the properties of magnetism and rotation for three of the magnetized planets in the solar system, namely the Earth, Jupiter, and Saturn. If we start off by looking at how heavy these planets are, if we set the mass of the Earth equal to one unit, Jupiter is more than 300 times as heavy as the Earth, and Saturn is about 95 times as massive. If the Earth's radius is again set to one unit, Jupiter's radius is more than 10 times as large, and Saturn's is just under that. Now, when we look at the periods of rotation, something very interesting is seen, because the Earth, as we know, rotates once every day, every 24-hour period. However, Jupiter and Saturn are much faster rotators. They have periods less than half a day. And so that's important because, for their size, these planets are very rapid rotators. If you're sitting at the equator on the Earth, the Earth's rotational motion carries you around at about something roughly 1 kilometer a second. And for these giant planets, that figure increases to something like 10 kilometers a second. So the rotational motion of these giant planets is very rapid. If we look at the intrinsic field strength of the planets, this can be measured by a very simple parameter known as the dipole moment, and it's just equal to the field strength at the equator on the surface of the planet multiplied by the cube of the planet's radius. If we set this equal to 1 for the Earth, Jupiter's intrinsic field is 18,000 times as strong as the Earth, so Jupiter has a very strong field indeed. But Saturn is, not exactly weak either. It's 550 times as strong as the Earth's field. Okay, so the giant planets are very strongly magnetized in comparison to the Earth. And now if we look at the dipole tilt angle, remember this is the angle between the rotational and the magnetic axes. Both the Earth and Jupiter have tilt angles of about 10 degrees, and Saturn mysteriously has a very small tilt angle. And current measurements constrain this to be less than 1 degree in the case of Saturn. So in other words, Saturn's magnetic and rotational axes are almost parallel. And that's a bit of a mystery, because the theories of how these fields are generated say that a planetary field which has that degree of symmetry will not be able to survive on timescales as long as the age of the solar system. So this is sort of a mystery of Saturn's field that we hope to try and unravel as we get more and more accurate measurements of the field strength surrounding the planet. Okay, if we go on to slide number 12, we sort of explore in a bit more detail the fact that these giant planets have very strong magnetic fields. One of the ingredients for generating these strong fields is the rapid rotation that we've already talked about. Another ingredient is the nature of the interior of the giant planets. Here we have a schematic view of Saturn, which has been cut away to reveal the structure of its interior. The planet is thought to have a rocky core, which is surrounded by a shell of hydrogen in a very exotic state. Essentially, it's thought that there is a layer of hydrogen surrounding the core of Saturn, which is in what's called a liquid metal form. The pressures at the interior of Saturn are enormous. They're more than 40 million times the atmospheric pressure at the surface of the Earth. And under these very extreme conditions, the bonds between the atoms in hydrogen molecules and even the electrons in the nuclei of hydrogen atoms weakens significantly, and you get effectively hydrogen in a conducting state. And you also get hydrogen in a liquid state. Now, you're never going to find hydrogen in this state in laboratories on the Earth, because we just can't reproduce the extreme physical conditions required to make it. But in theory, this form of hydrogen is thought to exist in the interior of Saturn, and it's thought to play a very important role in the generation of that planet's very strong magnetic field. Okay. If we move on to slide 13, this is just an introduction before we look at data of the magnetic environment of Saturn. Now, Saturn in this picture is that tiny disk that you can see near the center, surrounded by the rings. So you can see that in terms of the effect of Saturn's magnetic field on its environment, the region of influence is very large compared to the planet itself. Now, the reason that some of these structures that we're going to talk about in this picture here comes about is through the interaction between the planet's magnetic field and the solar wind, which you can see streaming in from the left in this picture here. Now, this solar wind is like a hot soup composed of charged particles, mainly negative electrons and positive protons, and the solar wind is continually streaming out from the sun all the time, and it moves radially outwards through the solar system and flows past the planets. Now, because the solar wind consists of charged particles, these guys can be deflected by strong magnetic fields, and of course Saturn has one, the Earth has one as well, and as does Jupiter. So essentially what happens is the field of Saturn deflects these solar wind particles, and they're forced to flow around the planet. But the story gets a bit more interesting because of the fact that the solar wind itself is moving so rapidly. The particles in the solar wind at Saturn's orbit are moving with velocities of typically 400 or 500 kilometers per second. And in fact, that's much faster than the speed at which pressure waves can propagate through the medium. And so what that means is that essentially the solar wind is a fluid that is moving supersonically past Saturn. So when you have a fluid moving in that fashion past an obstacle, the only way the obstacle can slow it down is through the formation of a shock wave. It's analogous to a supersonic aircraft moving through the Earth's atmosphere and the formation of a sonic boom, of a bow shock in front of it that leads to a sonic boom as it sweeps over observers on the ground. So the same sort of thing happens here. You can see the bow shock boundary on the left that's formed by this interaction. As solar wind material, which is also known as plasma or ionized gas, moves through the bow shock boundary, it becomes strongly heated and compressed and greatly slowed down. So just on the other side of the bow shock is the region known as the magnetosheath. And as we'll see, the magnetic field in the magnetosheath is very turbulent and very disordered compared to the other regions that we see here. As we move closer to the planet, we encounter the second main boundary in this interaction, which is known as the magnetopause. Now, the magnetopause is you can think of as a thin skin, which in general separates the magnetic field of the planet from the magnetic field and the plasma and the solar wind. So in general, solar wind material is flowing around the magnetopause boundary as it sweeps past the planet. If we look inside the magnetopause, this region is known as the magnetosphere. By definition, it's the region where the dynamics of the fields and the particles is dominated by Saturn's internal field, as well as the field due to some of these external sources that we see here. If we look at the representation of the field lines, we see that on the side of the planet facing the Sun, the day side, we have these dipole-like shapes. And on the night side, the dipole-like shapes persist as you look at regions very close to the planet, but as you get further from the planet, you see that the field lines are drawn out into this long tail-like configuration, which appropriately enough is known as the magnetotail. And before we move on, probably the most important thing to point out about these boundaries is that they are not static boundaries. They don't stay still. The density and the velocity of the solar wind are always changing, and as they change, so too do the locations of the bow shock and magnetopause boundaries. In general, a solar wind which is more dense and flows more rapidly is better at compressing Saturn's field, and so a faster, denser solar wind means smaller magnetosphere and more compressed bow shock and magnetopause boundaries. Okay, so let's move on to slide 14 and start talking a little bit about magnetometer science. On this slide here, you can see photographs of the two magnetic sensors that together comprise the Cassini magnetometer instrument. On the left, we have the Fluxgate magnetometer, or FGM, and this is a magnetometer which measures magnetic field using a system of coils, and it's situated about halfway along that 11-meter boom that we talked about coming out from the side of the spacecraft. On the right is the helium magnetometer, and that little ruler there in that picture is about 10 centimeters long, to give you an idea of how compact these sensors are. The helium magnetometer measures magnetic field through the effective magnetic field on the absorption properties of helium gas. Helium gas in the sensor is illuminated by polarized infrared light from a lamp and by measuring the absorption line seen from that gas, the direction and strength of the magnetic field can be inferred. What's important about the helium magnetometer is that it can be operated in what's known as scalar mode. And in this mode, was that a question?
It sounds like there's a question, or does somebody have an open line? You know what, Nick, I'll go off to the operator and see if we can isolate that line. Why don't you go ahead and go on?
Okay. Okay, so as I was saying, the helium magnetometer can be operated in a special mode known as scalar mode. And in scalar mode, we can no longer measure the direction of the magnetic field, but we can measure the field strength very accurately, up to about one part in a billion. And so what we do is, when we get very close to Saturn, we switch the helium magnetometer into scalar mode to get very accurate measurements of the field strength due to Saturn's internal force. And by doing so, we hope to be able to map the very complex components of the planet's internal field. So, in other words, components more complex than a simple dipole pattern. All right, so if we go on to slide 15, this is actual magnetometer data from Cassini, taken during the interval between June the 27th and the 29th last year, as the spacecraft was making its first approach towards Saturn. And what we've shown here in the top three panels as a function of time is the three components of the magnetic field. And this is just to emphasize that magnetic field is a three-dimensional quantity. It has strength and it has direction. But we'll concentrate for the purposes of this talk on the bottom panel, which is the total field strength in nanotesla units as a function of time, as well as time on the horizontal axis. We've also shown the distance or the range of the spacecraft from Saturn in units of Saturn radii. One Saturn radius is 60,000 kilometers, and you can see that during this interval of 3 days, the spacecraft went from a distance of 50 Saturn radii from the planet to a distance of something like 20 Saturn radii. So it covered a lot of distance and got closer to the planet during that time. So what's happening in terms of the magnetic field? Well, you can see that if you look at the first half of this time interval that we're studying, that the magnetic field exists in one of two very distinct states. First of all, you have a relatively low, quiet magnetic field of about half a nanotesla. And then this is interrupted at regular intervals by a slightly stronger and quite noisy magnetic field trace. And this is because the noisy field corresponds to the magnetosheath region and the quiet field corresponds to the solar wind. So during the first half of this interval, Cassini is making brief excursions into the magnetosheath as it approaches the planet. And of course, the reason that it does this is because Saturn's bow-shock boundary is always moving back and forth. And so as the spacecraft approaches the planet, sometimes it finds itself in the solar wind, sometimes it finds itself in the magnetosheath. So essentially, those jumps in field, which are marked here by the S labels, S1 through S7, are where the spacecraft crosses Saturn's bow-shock. Okay, so as time progresses and the spacecraft gets closer to the planet, you can see another transition in the properties of the field. The field starts to show these very large spikes. Okay, so we start off in the field of the magnetosheath after the S7 crossing, and then we start to see some very brief jumps in the field to higher field strength. And then during the times marked by the MP labels, we see a final transition into the very high, relatively smooth field. And by that stage, of course, we're inside Saturn's magnetosphere itself, where we find the strongest magnetic field measurements. Okay, so in essence, what we're seeing here is firstly a transition from the solar wind to the magnetosheath, and then from the magnetosheath to the magnetosphere. And we've had more than 10 orbits of Saturn since this data was taken, and we see these kind of crossings in all of the data, but of course in detail their properties are different. Okay, so now if we look at slide number 16, this is that same data that we saw, but visualized in a different way for people who are more, I guess, geometrically minded. What we're looking at here, you can think of as a view onto Saturn's orbital plane, the plane in which it orbits around the Sun. Saturn is this red dot that you can see at the origin. The distance along the horizontal axis is the distance from the planet towards the Sun, so the x-axis here is positive towards the Sun. and the vertical axis is essentially the distance perpendicular to the x direction. So essentially we've collapsed the y and the z coordinates into a single distance here. The parabolic curve that you can see going through the picture here is the spacecraft trajectory. So the spacecraft moved from the right-hand side up near Saturn and then back down through the left-hand side of that trajectory. You can see blue dots on the trajectory, which are time ticks spaced at intervals of one day. And, of course, the blue dots are crowded closer together as we get further from the planet, because the spacecraft moves more slowly the further it gets from the planet. You can also see that hanging off the spacecraft trajectory we have these blue lines, and these are representations of the field measured by the magnetometer. In particular, it was the VHM, the vector helium magnetometer. The length of the lines indicates the strength of the field, and the direction of the lines, as you might have guessed, indicates the field direction. You can also see two dashed curves that have been drawn here. The red dashed curve is a model of the average position of the bow shock, and the purple curve is a model of the average position of the magnetopause. The red crosses indicate where the spacecraft saw the bow shock, and the purple triangles indicate where it saw the magnetopause. So you can see that compared to the average positions that one would expect at Saturn for these boundaries, the Cassini data saw indications of a relatively expanded magnetosphere during the inbound path of this orbit. In other words, it encountered the bow shock and the magnetopause earlier than one would have expected. On the way out, the story is rather different. The spacecraft, as you can see by the triangle and the cross symbols, encountered the magnetopause and the bow shock earlier than expected on the way out, which indicates that the magnetosphere was relatively compressed on the outbound path. However, you can see that at the very end of the orbit shown here, we again see red crosses, and so the bow shock was once again seen where one would have expected to see it on average. And so that indicates that late on the outbound path of this first orbit, the magnetosphere expanded once again to something like its average position. So this indicates the magnetosphere of Saturn, as with the other planets, is a very dynamic place and is continually in motion. Before we leave slide 16, I'll also point out that the field measurements, which are these blue lines that you can see attached to the trajectory, seem to run more or less parallel to the magnetopause boundary. If you look at the purple dash curve and compare the field measurements that you see there, you can see that they're almost parallel to the magnetopause boundary. And the next slide, 17, hopefully explains to us why that should be the case. So in this slide here, we have Saturn as that blue dot. We have a cartoon representing Saturn's magnetopause surface surrounding the planet. And on the right here, we have the solar wind flowing in towards the magnetopause from the right. And what we're going to do here is we're going to follow the motion of two parcels or blobs of plasma in the solar wind. The first parcel is towards the top of the picture here, and this guy has a very simple kind of trajectory. He sails right past the magnetopause and never hits it. So he has a nice linear trajectory, and you can think of these as snapshots of the same blob spaced by regular intervals in time. So it's just a nice linear trajectory, and he sails right past Saturn and its magnetosphere. His friend towards the bottom of the picture, however, intersects Saturn's magnetopause surface much closer to the subsolar point. And so, of course, this parcel of plasma has to flow around the magnetopause surface because it can't penetrate it. And so it has a very different kind of trajectory. It gets closer to the magnetopause surface. It then decelerates and starts to leak around the magnetopause surface. And so subsequent snapshots of this guy might look like something that's as shown in the picture here. What's interesting about plasmas, such as solar wind, is that they're almost perfect electrical conductors. And so what that means is that if you have two blobs which are connected by the same magnetic field line as these two guys are, there's a law, a physical law, that says plasma blobs of plasma which start out moving on the same magnetic field line must remain connected by that field line. And so you can see the only way that these two guys can stay magnetically connected as they approach Saturn's magnetopause is if the field line itself distorts and wraps itself around the magnetopause surface. And you can see that what this means is that essentially the field pattern drapes itself around the obstacle of Saturn's magnetosphere, and appropriately this is known as magnetic draping, and it's a consequence of this property of fields and plasmas moving together, which is known as frozen in flow. And we'll see some more examples of that in the later part of the talk. Okay, if we move on to slide 18, this is a very busy plot, so I won't talk that much about it, but I just wanted to point it out because it's a very nice example of how we can work, of how we can compare data sets from different instruments on board Cassini and do science in that fashion, doing correlated studies. And this is work that was done by Emma Bunce, one of our co-investigators at the University of Leicester. The time interval that you see here represents the outbound path of the first orbit of Cassini. The panel in the middle here, which is marked B nanotesla, is the total field strength as a function of time. And essentially what I want to point out is that in the time interval that Emma has marked on the top as a hot plasma injection, you essentially see very strong disturbances, not only in the magnetic field data, but in data from other instruments on board Cassini. So if you look at the second panel, this is data from the radio and plasma wave subsystem, which measures electric field due to waves in the plasma environment of Saturn. Mm-hmm. And you can see that at the same time as the magnetic field disturbance, there is this very strong burst of radio waves across a very wide range of frequencies as compared with other times when it's a lot more quiet. The bottom two panels are data from the MIMI and CATS instruments on board Cassini, which measure the energy of particles in Saturn's plasma environment. And you can see that in both cases, the increased counts in one case and then the increased color scale in the bottom panel, the population of energetic particles dramatically increased again during this hot plasma injection event. And this injection itself comes about because material in the solar wind sometimes leaks in to Saturn's magnetosphere through so-called reconnection events, and hot plasma moves in towards closer to Saturn, and at the time shown, it happened to engulf the Cassini spacecraft. And this is why you see such disturbed measurements, not only in the magnetometer, but in all the other instruments as well. Okay, so if we move on to slide 19, this is magnetic data taken from the first flyby of Titan by the spacecraft. Titan orbits Saturn at a distance of 20 Saturn radii. Remember, one Saturn radius is about 60,000 kilometers. What's interesting about that is that Titan is very close to the boundary of Saturn's magnetosphere. It's generally quite close to the magnetopause. What's also interesting is that Titan takes about 16 days to do one orbit around Saturn. However, the material in which it is immersed, the magnetospheric material that's in which Titan is immersed at that distance, rotates around Saturn much more quickly than Titan. And essentially what this means is that magnetospheric material or plasma is continually sweeping past Titan at a velocity of something like 100 kilometers per second. So you have this very rapid flow of magnetized plasma past an obstacle. And as for the case of the solar wind and Saturn's magnetosphere, you expect to see some sort of effect on the magnetic field itself. And in fact, this is what you see here. The purple curve passing near Titan is the spacecraft trajectory. In this case, the spacecraft is moving from left to right, closer towards Saturn. Saturn is off to the right in this picture. Material in Saturn's magnetosphere, situated at Titan's orbit, is sweeping past Titan, and its direction of motion here is up out of the page towards us, the observer. Okay? You can see far that at large distances from Titan, the field measurements, which are indicated once more by these lines hanging off the spacecraft trajectory, generally point in the same direction. They're slightly inclined towards Saturn itself. You can see that close to Titan itself, the field becomes very strongly distorted, and in fact it looks as though the field is like fronds in a fringed curtain, and that this curtain is draping itself around the Titan obstacle. And in fact that's pretty much what's happening, because in order to flow around Titan, the material has to leak around the sides and over the top of the moon, and because the field and the plasma moves together, the magnetic field also drapes itself around the Titan obstacle. Okay, so slide 20 shows you a bit more detail of that interaction. Mainly the important thing to notice here is that you have the obstacle of Titan. Titan has this extended, rather thick atmosphere, which represents an additional obstacle to the flow of Saturn's magnetospheric material. You can see that there are these field lines which move with the material and which drape themselves around the Titan obstacle as material flows past. So material far from Titan at the top and the bottom of the picture moves relatively quickly and drags field lines with it. You can think of these field lines as rubber bands. Material which impacts on Titan closer, to its center, moves more slowly, decelerates, and leaks around the side of Titan, and so the field lines there are bent further back towards the direction of the magnetospheric flow. In this picture here, you can also see an extreme form of this draping, which is in the region on the right here behind Titan, known as the wake region of this flow. And you can see that above Titan's orbital plane, the field points towards Titan, and below the orbital plane, it points away from Titan. Okay, so if we look at the next slide, number 21, if we just concentrate on the right panels here, this is, again, magnetic field measured by the magnetometer at the first Titan flyby, and the red traces here are the measurements by the Cassini magnetometer, and the blue curve here is a model of this interaction between Saturn's magnetosphere and Titan, which was put together by Heiko Backus, a student at the University of Cologne. And you can see that for all the components of the field, Heiko's model is doing a very good job of producing the large-scale features of how the field changes with time. Now, the closest approach to Titan occurred when this top component of the field, the so-called BX component, dramatically changed sign. You can see that just past the time of about 15 hours, 30 minutes, there's this dramatic sign change in the BX component. And this occurred because the spacecraft crossed this wake region of Titan, and as we saw, the field changes direction as one moves through that wake. And that's exactly what the spacecraft is seeing here. Okay, so if we move on to slide 22, this is just a few more images of Titan that I'd like to show. Again, this is from the Imaging Science System on Cassini. And you can see the very... The famous clouds of Titan here in this image here. The radius of Titan is about 2,500 kilometers, and that makes it the second largest moon in the solar system, second only to Jupiter's satellite Ganymede. And Titan's atmosphere, as we'll see, is nitrogen rich, but also contains methane. If we go to the next slide, 23, this is data taken by the INMS instrument on board Cassini during that first Titan flyby. And we can see here that where we have density of different molecules in Titan's atmosphere as measured by INMS, the ion neutral mass spectrometer, as a function of altitude above Titan's surface. So here we're looking at about 1,200 to 1,600 kilometers above Titan's surface. What we have is three profiles of three different molecules in the atmosphere. You can see that nitrogen is the most abundant molecule, N2. There is The next most abundant then is CH4 or methane, and then this followed by H, which is molecular hydrogen. The red symbols here are data taken during the inbound pass, and the blue taken during the outbound pass of that flyby. And you can see that in general there seem to be these wave-like disturbances, but in general the profiles indicate a fairly steady composition for Titan's atmosphere. On the bottom of the graph are shown data from the Voyager UVS instrument. And remember, Voyager flew by Saturn more than 25 years ago, and so the fact that these data are more or less continuous with the INMS data indicate that Titan's atmosphere is stable, fairly stable in terms of composition over long time scales. Okay, moving on to slide number 24. This is the famous pictures that appeared in the media that were taken by the Huygens probe as it descended towards Titan in January the 14th of this year. And you can see different landscapes on Titan here. You can see these ridges or channels, which are thought to have been once fed by flows of liquid methane or methane rain on Titan. And you can see towards the bottom of these pictures a much smoother landscape, which the Huygens probe, near which the Huygens probe landed and was thought to have the texture of something like wet sand. So it's almost like a huge beach where the liquid is dominantly methane, liquid methane. Okay, the next slide shows an image of Titan's surface, this time taken by an instrument on board the Cassini orbiter. Cassini has a radar instrument, and the radar instrument operates at wavelengths which effectively allow it to peer through the thick haze surrounding Titan and onto its surface. And you can see on the right here the rim of a rather large crater that was discovered on the surface of Titan, at more than 400 kilometres wide. It's fairly rare that these sorts of features are seen, and so it's thought that there is a dynamic continual reshaping of the surface of Titan due to liquid flows. Slide number 26 finally shows us some magnetometer data that was taken during a flyby of the satellite Enceladus by Cassini earlier this year. Enceladus orbits Saturn at a distance of about 4 Saturn radii, so it's much closer in than Titan. The panel on the left here shows you the magnetic field vectors which were measured by the magnetometer during the first flyby in February this year. And you can see that at closest approach to Enceladus, there is this strong distortion in the field. Again, you see a pattern that looks as though the field is draping itself around Enceladus. What's interesting about this is that the field draping indicates that there's an obstacle which is much larger than Enceladus itself. And on the basis of this measurement, we did the project allowed a much closer flyby of Enceladus in the 14th of July this year. And for that very close flyby, which was about 750 kilometres above the surface of Enceladus, all the instruments on Cassini saw some kind of interaction due to the presence of Enceladus in Saturn's magnetosphere. On the right there is a schematic diagram of what's happening with the field. As hot plasma in Saturn's magnetosphere flows past Enceladus, because of this frozen in condition that we've been talking about, the field distorts itself and drapes itself around the Enceladus obstacle. The obstacle shown in this picture here is this haze of gas, which is essentially steam, water, surrounding Enceladus, but observations taken since then indicate that the source of the outgassing on Enceladus is asymmetric. There seems to be a lot more steam coming from the southern hemisphere of Enceladus, and so we're refining this picture all the time. And so the idea here is that Enceladus, there's strong outgassing from the moon, from its icy surface being broken up. Enceladus is continually adding mass to the plasma in Saturn's magnetosphere. As water molecules leave the surface of the satellite, they become ionized. Once they become ionized or charged, they can be affected by the magnetic field and they get swept up with the other flow of magnetospheric material. Okay, so investigation of Enceladus is very interesting and ongoing. And if we move on to the final slide here, One could also say that about the exploration of Saturn in general. So thank you for listening.
Are there any questions? I guess I had a question, Nick. The two instruments that you described, which one is more sensitive?
The helium magnetometer is more sensitive when it's operated in scalar mode because then it can detect field strength of better than one part in a million. If you operate either instrument in vector mode, they can measure field strength of something like one part in 10,000. So the helium magnetometer in scalar mode is definitely, I think, is the most sensitive in those sorts of terms.
So, for example, when you were flying by Titan, the TA data that you showed on page 21, is that coming more from the vector magnetometer or more from the helium part way at the end?
The data on page 21 comes from the helium magnetometer in vector mode.
Okay.
The helium magnetometer essentially from up to a field strength of 256 nanotesla, it can measure field in vector mode, and as soon as you get to field stronger than that, by which time you're something like 4 Saturn radii or closer to the planet, you need to switch it over into scalar mode because the vector mode saturates and you can't get any further vector measurements. However, the Fluxgate magnetometer takes vector measurements over a very wide range of fields, so we always have something to compare the helium magnetometer measurements with.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Question.
Yes.
Matthew, the Saturn observation campaign. What effect does the magnetosphere have on the spokes that are seen in the rings?
My understanding, it's sketchy admittedly, is that the spokes in the rings are not always seen. In fact, I think that the ISS team reported seeing spokes in the rings for the first time quite recently for Cassini. So then the question remains, what causes the appearance of these dark spokes in the rings? And one explanation I've heard people talk about in a very sort of abstract kind of way is that it might be due to the presence of charged particles of dust being trapped in the magnetic field and essentially levitating somewhere above the surface of the ring plane. But that's about the extent of my knowledge on that.
Question.
Any more questions?
Yes, please.
Yep.
Thanks, first, for the hour. It's been very interesting. I have a question, though, about an event that occurred when the probe was passing Jupiter. As I recall it, there was a coronal mass ejection roughly timed so that there was an interaction between the output of the sun and what the magnetometer was able to detect on the Cassini probe relative to the magnetometer on the Galileo probe. Could you describe those events?
Yes. The flyby of Jupiter occurred in late 2000, early 2001, and essentially what happened during the event you're describing is that Galileo and Cassini were able to determine simultaneous measurements of the position of Jupiter's magnetopause boundary. And that was very interesting because it indicated that the passage of the coronal mass ejection past Jupiter was compressing the subsolar portion of the magnetopause at the time the observations were taken. So in other words, We got a very rare view by two spacecraft of a planetary magnetopause, and not only that, but we caught the magnetopause in the act of being compressed by a transient solar wind event, such that the subsolar portion of the magnetopause measured by Galileo was a lot more compressed compared to what Cassini was seeing.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
I have a question.
I have a question.
Yes.
Now, if you could refresh my memory, you mentioned that you were seeing some of the same data with Cassini that you saw with Voyager 20-something years ago. What was that data again?
Well, essentially, Cassini saw the same, in general, the same kinds of things as the spacecraft makes the transition of Saturn's magnetosphere. We see an encounter with the planet's bow shock and with the magnetopause. However, the Cassini observations during the first orbit indicate that Saturn's magnetosphere was relatively expanded compared to what Voyager saw during the inbound path of the orbit, and relatively compressed to what Voyager saw during the outbound path.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I have a question on the question of why it's unexpected to have the rotational tilt correspond with the magnetic pole.
Well, again, my knowledge here is quite limited, but my understanding is, from talking to the field modeling guys, that if you have a field configuration where the magnetic and rotational axes are parallel, that field should is not sustainable by dynamo action. It should just decay away on a time scale, which I believe is somewhat shorter than the age of the solar system, and so you wouldn't expect that field to survive on very long time scales. And so it's quite a mystery why the field of Saturn is so axisymmetric. It indicates either that Saturn's field is being generated in a way that we don't understand, or that there is some kind of process happening in its interior that causes our external observations of the field to appear more axisymmetric than what they are in reality.
I'm afraid I still don't understand why something spinning like a dynamo, what would trigger that to dissipate if the planet is rotating symmetrically?
I think you need the combination of, I believe in the dynamo you have a combination of the rotation of the planet and the convective motions in the interior, and so you're always sort of breaking and forming the field in a sense to generate it. And my understanding is that a consequence of that is that you expect there to be a measurable angle between the magnetic and rotational axes. And I think that's the extent of my knowledge, but you'd have to ask one of the sort of field modeling guys to learn more about that.
Hi, this is Rachel from Virginia. I have a question I hope you can answer.
Okay.
In doing outreach with a lot of elementary schools, I seem to be getting the same question a lot, and I can't answer it. The question is, if you count Saturn's rings, or if you include Saturn's rings, would Saturn have more mass than Jupiter? Which is great that the kids are beginning to think about this.
My feeling would be no. I mean, I've never done the calculation, but my feeling would be that probably not, because Saturn itself is something like 100 times the mass of the Earth. Jupiter is 300 times the mass of the Earth, and so essentially what that means is that you would have to have twice the mass of Saturn contained in its rings if the whole system was to exceed Jupiter's mass, and I don't think that's very likely.
The mass of Saturn's rings are roughly the mass of one of the small moons, maybe a bigger than Hyperion, but not much. So the answer is no. Yeah, you had it right on there.
Okay.
It's great that they're asking a question like that.
Yeah, it's very good.
I mean, Saturn's rings look quite a bit, they look like they contain just a whole bunch of mass, but it's just broken up into very small particles and spread out over a very large area.
Right. In fact, I think overall, Saturn is supposed to have a density less than water, so if you had an ocean large enough, Saturn would float in it, right?
Yep. Do we have any more questions?
Yeah, I have a question about Titan. I'd like to know the influence of the magnetic field on the chemistry and the atmosphere.
Okay, Titan, the observations that we've taken indicate that Saturn's field penetrates into Titan's atmosphere somewhat. It doesn't penetrate completely because currents flow in Titan's ionosphere, and they sort of shield Titan against Saturn's field partially, but not completely. So you do have penetration of the field into Titan's atmosphere to a certain extent. What that means is that energetic particles in Saturn's atmosphere can flow down along field lines and actually intercept Titan's atmospheric material at certain patches on the surface of Titan. And in essence, what that means is that you have an extra source of ionization in theory for Titan's atmospheric material. So you have the solar ionization source as well as ionization from this sort of magnetospheric rain of energetic particles that follow the field to which Titan is connected.
But it's negligible, I guess, compared to the moon itself, then.
That's not very well known. People need to sort of do more detailed calculations of the interaction between the magnetosphere and Titan itself to get a better idea of that.
Are there any other questions? Okay, well, I'd like to thank Nick very much for joining us. We know it's quite a bit later for you there in England than it is for us here in the States, so we appreciate you staying up late and telling us about the magnetometer results. Next month, we'll be joined by Dr. Bill Kurtz. He'll be talking about the radio and plasma wave experiment and the results from that experiment over the course of the last year or so. And take a look for the email I just sent out regarding the 508 compliance and the passwords and the linking to the password-protected site. And if you have any questions, go ahead and contact the charm_leads@cdsa.jpl.nasa.gov. And with that, we'll say...
Trina,
yeah,
this is
sure.
Jane. I will send the announcement out to the Saturn Observation Campaign members, so those of you that are on the phone. Fear not, I'll be sending you that information shortly.
Now,
will
the SSA people be getting that information, too?
They should. Kay Ferrari is on my distribution, and
yep.
She typically forwards it back
okay.
out to her solar system ambassadors.
Yeah.
But I'll pick up the phone and give her a ring to make sure.
Thank you.
Right. You didn't send it to us directly.
Right. I send it to what I call a charm distribution, and then we have the solar system ambassadors and the Saturn observation campaign sort of
and
explodes
museums.
From there.
And museums, too.
And museums also, yes.
Yeah. Anita will send out to the museum people.
Right, because I got in here just you were talking about that, and I didn't quite understand
yep.
what was going on. It sounded important.
It all will be revealed in the email.
And I went ahead and put the password and the username in the email for folks so that they have a record of it. Okay, thanks, everybody, and have a great month. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Thanks, Trina. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.
Bye.
Richard saying goodbye. Thank you.